Chapter 2. Faith, the second part of this night, is our next subject for discussion. Faith is that admirable means of advancing to God, our goal. And God, we said, is also for the soul a part, or the third cause of this night. Faith, the means, is comparable to midnight. We can affirm, then, that it is darker for a man than the first part of the night, and in a certain way darker than the third. The first part, pertinent to the senses, resembles twilight, the time sensible objects begin to fade from sight. Accordingly, it is not a time so far removed from all light as is midnight. The third part, that period before the dawn, approximates the light of day. The darkness is not like that of midnight, since in this third period of the night we approach the illumination of day, and this daylight we compare to God. Although, naturally speaking, God is indeed as dark a night to the soul as is faith, it can be affirmed that he is less dark. For when these three parts of the night, which are night to the soul from a natural viewpoint, have passed, God supernaturally illumines the soul with the ray of his divine light. This light is the principle of the perfect union which follows after the third night. The first night pertains to the lower, sensory part of man's nature, and is consequently more external. As a result, the second night is darker. The second, darker night of faith belongs to the rational, superior part. It is darker and more interior because it deprives this part of its rational light, or better, it blinds it. Accordingly, it is indeed comparable to midnight, the innermost and the darkest period of night. We must prove now how this second part, faith, is night to the spirit, just as the first is to the senses. Then we shall also discuss the factors in opposition to this night, and how a person prepares actively for entering it. In its proper place, we shall speak of passivity, that is, of God's work, without the soul, in effecting this night. I plan to discuss this matter in the third book. Chapter 3. Faith, the theologians say, is a certain and obscure habit of soul. It is an obscure habit because it brings us to believe divinely revealed truths which transcend every natural light and infinitely exceed all human understanding. As a result, the excessive light of faith bestowed on man is darkness for him, because a brighter light will eclipse and suppress a dimmer one. The sun so obscures all other lights that they do not seem to be lights at all when it is shining, and instead of affording vision to the eyes, it overwhelms, blinds, and deprives them of vision. Since its light is excessive and in proportioned to the visual faculty, similarly, the light of faith in its abundance suppresses and overwhelms that of the intellect. For the intellect, by its own power, comprehends only natural knowledge, though it has the potency to be raised to a supernatural act whenever our Lord wishes. A man of himself knows only in the natural way, that is, by means of the senses. If he is to know in this natural way, the phantasms and species of objects will have to be present either in themselves or in their likenesses. Otherwise he will be incapable of knowing naturally, as the scholastic philosophers say. Knowledge arises in the soul from both the faculty and the object at hand. If a person were told of objects he had never known or seen resemblances of, he would in the end have no more knowledge than before. For example, if a man were informed that on a certain island there was an animal whose like or kind he had never seen, he would then leave no more idea or image of that animal in his mind than previously, no matter how much he was told. Another clearer example will shed more light on this subject. If a man born blind were told about the nature of the color white or yellow, he would understand absolutely nothing, no matter how much instruction he received. Since he never saw these colors, nor their like, he would not have the means to form a judgment about them. Only their names would be grasped, since the names are perceptible through hearing, but never their form or image, because these colors were never seen by him. Such is faith to the soul. It informs us of matters we have never seen or known, either in themselves or in their likenesses. In fact, nothing like them exists. The light of natural knowledge does not show us the object of faith, since this object is unproportioned to any of the senses. Yet we come to know it through hearing, by believing what faith teaches us, blinding our natural light and bringing it into submission. St. Paul states, "This amounts to saying that faith is not a knowledge deprived from the senses, but an asset of the soul to what enters through hearing. Faith, moreover, far exceeds what these examples teach us. Not only does it fail to produce knowledge and science, but as we said, it deprives and blinds a person of any other knowledge or science by which he may judge it. Other knowledge is acquired by the light of the intellect, but not the knowledge that faith gives. Faith nullifies the light of the intellect, and if this light is not darkened, the knowledge of faith is lost. Accordingly, Isaiah said, 'If you do not believe, you will not understand.' Faith manifestly is a dark night for man, but in this very way it gives him light. The more darkness it brings upon him, the more light it sheds. For by blinding, it illumines him, according to those words of Isaiah, that if you do not believe, you will not understand. That is, you will not have light." Faith was foreshadowed in that cloud which separated the children of Israel just before their entry into the Red Sea from the Egyptians. Scripture says of the cloud, "The cloud was dark and illuminative in the night." How wonderful it was, a cloud, dark in itself, could illumine the night. This was related to illustrate how faith, a dark and obscure cloud to man, also a night, in that it blinds and deprives him of his natural light, illumines and pours light into the darkness of his soul by means of its own darkness. This is fitting that the disciple be like the master. A man in darkness does not receive adequate enlightenment save by another darkness, according to David's teaching. The day brims over and breathes speech to the day, and the night manifests knowledge to the night. Expressed more clearly, this means the day, which is God, in bliss where it is day, communicates and pronounces the word, his Son, to the angels and blessed souls who are now day. And this he does that they may have knowledge and enjoyment of him. And the night, which is the faith present in the church militant, where it is still night, manifests knowledge to the church and consequently to every soul. This knowledge is nigh to a man because he does not yet possess the clear beatific wisdom, and because faith blinds him as to his own natural light. Our deduction is that since faith is a dark night, it illumines the soul that is in darkness. We verify then David's assertion on this matter. Night will be my illumination in the midst of my delights. This amounts to saying, the night of faith will be my guide in the delights of my pure contemplation and union with God. By this passage, David clearly informs us of the darkness demanded on this road if a soul is to receive light. Chapter 4. I believe you are learning how faith is a dark night for the soul, and how the soul as well must be dark, or in darkness as to its own light, that it may allow itself to be guided by faith to this high goal of union. But for knowledge of how to do this, a somewhat more detailed explanation of the darkness required for entering this abyss of faith will be beneficial. In this chapter, I will deal with this darkness generally. Further on, with God's help, I will present a more detailed explanation of the behavior necessary for obviating error in faith and any encumbrance to its guidance. I affirm then that if a person takes faith as a good guide to this state, not only must he live in darkness in the sensory or lower part of his nature, concerning creatures and temporal things, which we have already discussed, but he must also darken and blind himself in that part of his nature which bears relation to God in spiritual things. This latter part, which we are now discussing, is the rational and higher portion of his nature. The attainment of supernatural transformation manifestly demands a darkening of the soul and an elevation above all the sensory and rational parts of nature. For the word supernatural indicates which is above nature. Nature consequently remains beneath. Since this transformation and union is something that falls beyond the reach of the senses and of human capability, the soul must empty itself perfectly and voluntarily. I mean its affection and will of all the earthly and heavenly things that it can grasp. It must, through its own efforts, empty itself in so far as it can. As for God, who will stop him from accomplishing his desires in the soul that is resigned, annihilated, and despoiled? In so far as he is capable, a person must void himself of all, so that however many supernatural communications he receives, he will continue to live as though deluded of them and in darkness. Like a blind man, he must lean on dark faith, accept it for his guide and light, and rest on nothing of what he understands, tastes and feels or imagines. All these perceptions are a darkness that will lead him astray. Faith lies beyond all this understanding, taste, feeling, and imagination. If he does not blind himself in these things and abide in total darkness, he will not reach what is greater, the teaching of faith. A man who is not yet entirely blind will not allow a good guide to lead him. Still able to perceive a little, he thinks that road he sees is the best, for he is unable to see other and better ones. And because he is the one giving the orders, he will consequently lead astray his young guide, who has better vision. Similarly, if the soul in traveling this road leans upon any elements of its own knowledge or experience of God, it will easily go astray or be detained for not having desired to abide in complete blindness, in faith, which is its guide. For however impressive may be one's knowledge or feeling of God, that knowledge or feeling will have no resemblance to God and amount to very little. Saint Paul implied this in his assertion: he who would approach union with God should believe in his existence. This is like saying, to attain union with God, a person should advance neither by understanding, nor by the support of his own experience, nor by feeling or imagination, but by belief in God's being. For God's being cannot be grasped by the intellect, appetite, imagination, or any other sense, nor can it be known in this life. The most that can be felt and tasted of God in this life is infinitely distant from God and the pure possession of Him. Isaiah and Saint Paul affirm, no eye has ever seen, nor ear heard, nor has the heart or thought of man ever grasp what God has prepared for those who love Him. Now a man may be striving for a perfect union in this life through grace with that to which through glory he will be united in the next, with what Saint Paul says eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of carnal man grasped. But manifestly, the perfect union in this life through grace and love demands that he live in darkness to all the objects of sight, hearing, imagination, and everything comprehensible to the heart, that is, to the soul. A man then is decidedly hindered from the attainment of this high state of union with God when he is attached to any understanding, feeling, imagining, opinion, desire, or way of his own, or to any other of his works or affairs, and knows not how to detach and denude himself from these impediments. His goal transcends all of this, even the loftiest objects that can be known or experienced. Consequently, he must pass beyond everything to unknowing. As regards this road to union, entering on the road means leaving one's own road, or better, moving on to the goal, and turning from one's own mode implies entry into what has no mode, that is, God. A person who reaches this state no longer has any modes or methods, still less is he, nor can he be, attached to them. I am referring to modes of understanding, taste, and feeling. Within himself, though, he possesses all methods, like one who, though having nothing, yet possesses all things. By being courageous enough to pass beyond the interior and exterior limits of his nature, he enters within supernatural bounds. bounds that have no mode, yet in substance possesses all modes. To reach the supernatural bounds, a person must depart from his natural bounds and leave self far off in respect to his interior and exterior limits in order to mount from a low state to the highest. Passing beyond all that is naturally and spiritually intelligible or comprehensible, a person ought to desire with all his might to attain what in this life is unknowable and unimaginable, and parting company with all he can or does, taste and feel, temporally and spiritually, he must ardently long to acquire what surpasses all taste and feeling. To be empty and free for the achievement of this, he should by no means seize upon what he receives spiritually or sensitively, as we shall explain in our particular discussion of this matter, but consider it of little import. The higher rank and esteem a man gives to all his knowledge, experience, or imagining, whether spiritual or not, the more he subtracts from the supreme good, and the more he delays in his journey toward him. And the less he esteems what he can possess relative to the supreme good, however estimable it may be, the more he values and prizes him, and consequently the closer he comes to him. In this way, in obscurity, a man swiftly approaches union by means of faith, which is also dark, and in this way faith gives him wondrous light. Obviously, if a person should desire to see, he would be in darkness as regards to God more quickly than if he opened his eyes to the blinding brightness of the sun.